Mandy. I'm a food addict. And it is August 21st, 2005, is that right? And I'm making a tape for Massachusetts Bay in a group. And I'm grateful to be able to do this because people in these rooms have saved my life. So, and I'm grateful to be able to give back and serve by telling my story. And I hope to give people hope that we never have to take a compulsive bite again, and we never have to hurt ourselves with food again. And I owe a debt of service and gratitude to Massachusetts Bay Intergroup for numerous things. The people in these rooms, like I said, have helped save my life with phone calls and with the service they've done, and opening their homes literally to help me be here. I think from the very beginning, I was a food addict. My very first words that I ever said in my whole life, my mom asked me, who wants this particular breakfast item? And I said, I do. And that's the very first words I've ever spoken in my whole life. So it's like right from the beginning, something was off with me in the food. But growing up, I definitely had an unusual relationship with food, that it was my comfort, it was my joy, it was my happiness. My grandma, there was one time I was visiting her, my brother and I were visiting her in Iowa, and I said to my grandma, my brother and I can eat this whole thing by ourselves. And she looked at me and she said, I bet you can. And just like the shame and the hurt of having my grandma look at, say something like that to me. And I kept a little box in my room of like food items, and my parents thought I was so good because I wouldn't eat them right away because it was all like treats and stuff like that. But then later on, I'd go into the bathroom and eat them all in one sitting in the bathroom, and so there was unusual behavior there. And then in middle school, I think once puberty hit, I stopped playing soccer because I played soccer from like maybe third grade till middle school, and then I stopped playing soccer in sixth grade. And I didn't do much of anything. I was involved in school somewhat, like in the, like maybe a student council or stuff like that, or they call it Odyssey of the Mind. It's another group. But when puberty hit, I think my weight especially started to go up more progressively. And then it just got worse and worse. And in the high school, especially when I got my license, the eating just took off. That I was sneaking food, stealing food, eating food that wasn't mine, getting high off, like pulling things out of the refrigerator and the freezer and eating them real quick. And then if I heard somebody coming up the stairs into the kitchen, I would, or coming down the stairs into the kitchen, I would either quick put the food away or act like I just got it out, and then pretend that it was normal and always eat everything but maybe just the last bit, because I didn't ever want to be the one who finished off the last bit of it. Things like stealing food, eating all of it, having to go out and buy another one, and then eating again to the point where it was originally, and then eating beyond that again, and the rearranging of food, and it got to the point in my disease where I would throw food away, and then I would take it back out of the trash and justify it was on the top, it was still in its wrapper, stuff like that. And they got, and towards the end when I think I was actually either in program at that time or had just was about to be coming into program, there's one time that my dad smoked cigarettes, and I poured his cigarette ashes on top of the trash so I wouldn't eat out of it, because I would still justify if it was still in the bag, and the food itself hadn't touched the trash, then it was still good. So literally, like, the gutter eater. I have to laugh. The first time I weighed and measured my food before program was my brother and I would go trick-or-treating with pillowcases. And so we come home after we trick-or-treated and put our food in the scale and see who got the most pounds of food. And so that was my first experience ever weighing and measuring food, I think, is putting it on the bathroom scale to see if I had more trick-or-treats than my brother. And I think probably in high school is when it started, the shame around it and the fact that it wasn't normal started to come more, and it became my best friend. I could be the life of the party. I could be in front of people being the martyr or just hanging out, and I was the rock. I was the one who, I thought I was the rock, that I'll be there for you, but then I don't have any issues of my own. I don't need help. And then that song that I'm an island, you know, I definitely identify with that. But then I always think now, if I was having such a good time, if I was having so much fun, why did I have to come home and eat? Why did I have to come home and binge and hurt myself? And I would stay up till crazy hours at night and sleep in, and then feel just like that habit of wanting to feel that clean feeling, then I would exercise compulsively or go to the gym, or I would shower or whatever it took to try to make myself feel clean, always wanting to be brand new, always wanting that clean slate. I remember one time, like, I would start exercising exactly at midnight or exactly, like, on the dot, because now I'm brand new. Now I won't be myself anymore. Now I'll change. This is official. It's different from now on. And part of my story, one of the things I did because of this disease, my sophomore year in high school, I mean, in college, the night I told my dad I had an eating disorder, I shaved my head. I shaved it bald. And now looking back, it's like, that's clearly insane. And plus it was cold, because it was like upstate New York in the fall. But my reason for doing that was, again, that like I want something external to make me feel from now on I'm different. From now on everything's going to be okay. From now on I'm not going to be the old person. And when I first got abstinent, people would say, oh, you look so different, you look so great, I don't recognize you. That would give me relief, because I so didn't like the person who I used to be. So to hear somebody say, I don't recognize you, you look different, was almost relief to hear that. And now that kind of makes me sad a little bit, because now I can look back and, like the big book said, I don't regret the past. I don't wish to shut the door on it, because God is powerful and God has used the past. It's something that I thought was like my curse, having an eating disorder, and God has used it, and I wouldn't be here today if it weren't for you guys and for this fellowship and the big book and a higher power and my sponsor, all the sponsors that I've had. But things getting worse in high school, I stole food from my locker mate. But I think the eating really took off, especially when I got to college, because then I grew up in Colorado in a town called Broomfield, and went to college in central New York, basically because I was trying to run away from home and the geographic cure and run away from myself. But everything was switched from what was familiar to me, and so I just turned towards food and the all-you-can-eat dining halls. And there was one time, freshman year at dorm hall, some girls made I guess it's like the Catholic communion wafers. I'm not sure what you call those, but for me, the food addict, I thought, first of all, if they leave it in the kitchen, it's a free-for-all. That's what I always justify. And also, I didn't think they were wafers. I thought they were cookies. So I took one. I stole one, thinking, of course, that it's in the kitchen. It's just out in the open. It's not really stealing. That was always my justification, because if I'd asked, they would have said it was okay, so therefore it's not stealing. But I bit into it, and I'm like, this is not a cookie, you know? And so I threw it away, and then later when I realized, like, that it was, I'm like, oh my gosh, like I stole Jesus bread and threw it away. And it's like, I don't think about that, and I hope I don't offend any Catholics. It's just part of my story is that's something that I did in my eating past. But things got worse. I went to counseling my second semester as a freshman. And then I still thinking if I could just get the family history thing down, if we could just figure out like what happened in my childhood, then I wouldn't need to eat. And that was his thinking, that like you deal with your past, you fix that, and then and maybe that was helpful. Maybe it helped me look at issues in my family that I needed to look at. But at the same time, it didn't work, because I would binge and go to counseling and binge and write like dear dad letters that I was angry with my dad, and then I would tear him into little pieces and like send him down the river and think, okay, now I'm new, now I'm brand new, and now I can move on, but still be binging and eating. And that summer, I tried to control my weight a little bit. Part of my story is I think I've caused my own knee injury several times. I played rugby partially in college, and I've torn my ACL in both knees and have had surgery twice, and because I just didn't know when to quit, didn't know when to say when. And then I went back to counseling for my eating disorder my first semester of my sophomore year. And still miserable, and things were getting worse. There came a point when I was controlling it, like the big book talks about, that periods of control, but that they usually lead to incomprehensible demoralization. And I felt that snap, that moment where I picked up the food again, and I felt like it was compulsive. And I just remember that experience of incomprehensible demoralization of what I did to myself. My eating stopped working for me. I couldn't get high enough off the food anymore. So I turned to other things like alcohol. I drank to the point where I was sick. I started smoking pot, and I want to keep the focus on the food, but that's just also how my disease progressed, that the food was not, I couldn't get high enough anymore. I'd be going to places knowing I was going to binge, knowing I just wasn't numbing me out enough for the kind of chaos I had created for myself. So by God's grace, spring break of my sophomore year, my plans got canceled. I was going to go on my fantasy trips. I just was going to fly to Amsterdam and stay in a hostel, and I don't know where these ideas come from, but I didn't end up doing that, thank God. And I went online, and I was looking up information about eating disorders and thinking, like, there was some brain chemistry that was off. I just need to pop some pill, and maybe serotonin needs to get back in place, and then I'll be okay. I went online, and OA came up, the OA website, and I saw the steps. And I still remember the things that struck me about the steps. The first step was, I'm powerless over food. My life is unmanageable. And then we move on. It's like the word food is addressed once in the first step and never again in the steps. And something about that, like, clicked. It seemed simple and true and made sense to me. And another thing that struck me is God as I understand him. And the power of that alone, even in the big book, it talks about, why don't you choose your own conception of a higher power, because I was hardcore agnostic. Thought anybody who was anything but agnostic, really, how can anybody say they know God? How can anybody be anything but agnostic? And I thought if I was going to be converted, I would have never come into these rooms. So the fact that I have the power of choice, that it's up to me to decide who my God is or isn't, or if it's the group, the fellowship, whatever it is, that it's all welcome, you know, the power of that did kind of melt that icy intellect soul mountain that Bill W. talks about, because I was definitely the intellect, definitely prided myself in intelligence, but I like that saying that my best thinking got me into these rooms. So I saw the steps, still didn't go to meeting, intended to go to meeting, but didn't go to meeting. Went home for the summer and back to Colorado in between my sophomore and junior year of college, and went to my first OA meeting, and it was relief. I think I said, I'm Mandy, I'm a compulsive overeater, and I'm not even sure if I got that before I started crying, but then God used my laziness, because a meeting that's in my hometown that was closer happened to be a meeting where people weighed and measured, did no flour, no sugar, and carried that message, and so I went to that meeting just because it was the closest and it was in my hometown, and that's where I found my first sponsor. She called me the next day, and then I called her back the day after that, and she asked if I wanted her to sponsor me, and I said, I remember thinking, like, well, what option do I have, you know, like, if I'm screaming on the inside, this person says to help, but I'm going to say, no, I don't want that kind of help, I want the kind of help that looks different like this. But so I said, all right, and she said, here's what you're going to do, and she said, you're going to weigh and measure, no flour, no sugar, 3 meals a day, nothing in between. She gave me kind of a structure to use the phone to break out of isolation, making 3 phone calls a day, writing gratitude, asking God for help in the morning and night, taking quiet time, reading the literature morning and night, writing my food down, making sure it was in the house, eating exactly what I committed, getting on the digital scale, and I still do those things today. And I'm grateful for those things. I think that structure has allowed me to stay abstinent, and because I'm abstinent, I now have the mental clarity to work on the steps, which is to me where the permanent recovery and the real recovery happens, because this is so important. For me, I've learned with or without the food, I'm insane. The food just masks that. And when I get abstinent and I have the clarity to see my thinking and see the insanity of it, it's so much like the big book talks about. I have the physical allergy and the mental obsession. And once the physical allergy is done, because I'm not picking up the flour and sugar and I'm weighing and measuring, so because one bite over or under it can trigger the craving, then there's the mental obsession is still there. And that's why I need the 12 steps, so that having had a spiritual awakening, I won't want the first bite, because that's what the insanity is. It tells me it's still okay to have that first bite, that I look normal, or I've been thin long enough, or I've been doing this long enough, that or it's okay to have whatever. And so that insanity, to really deal with that, that's what the spiritual awakening is, because I was abstinent, but I was still restless, irritable, and discontented, and wondering what was wrong. I'm doing everything that they told me to do. I'm working every tool every day. I'm doing everything to the best of my ability. Why am I still feeling restless, irritable, and discontented? And I realized that it's a lie that food is my ease and comfort, that God is my ease and comfort today. So I started working the steps as laid out in the big book. And even just reading out of the big book to do that, those first three steps, was relief to me. It was, there was this power, and the big book would just start coming alive. There was this power that would come through, and I started to be able to see my insanity like they had written about it in the big book, and see the disease, see how I identified with Bill, and thinking, okay, these people aren't saying that they are in recovery. They said, I have recovered. There are people who have recovered. And that, to me, it was such powerful language, because I heard somebody say once on a tape, she was so sick of being in recovery, she needed to be recovered. And I can't be cured. The physical allergy isn't going to go away. Once I'm a pickle, I can't turn back into a cucumber. But that gave me such hope to read the words, people who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind, body, and spirit, or whatever it says, to paraphrase. So that just gave me such hope to see those. So I went through the big book with the sponsor, and I told her how I identified with the big book. I told her how I felt irritable, restless, and discontented, even in abstinence. I told her, I just told her about my neuroticism. I told her, like, I was just rigorously honest to the best of my ability, because people tell me that this whole program can be summed up in one word, and that's honesty. And for me, as an addict, I thought, I am honest. You know, I'm working every tool every day, and if they overcharge me on, or undercharge me on lettuce, I go and give them the extra 3 cents for the lettuce that I owe them, you know, and, like, the neurotic honesty I had before. And, but what I heard is honesty is being void of self-deception, and that I did not have. I still thought, if I work every tool every day and just, if I'm perfect, then I can be safe. And I was equating safety with working every tool every day, and the tools are really my gods. And somebody said, that's superstitious to think if I work every tool every day, that's going to keep me safe. Because I learned today my safety comes from God. And I still strongly believe in every tool every day. That's the structure that lets me have the abstinence key that gets me open to enter the house so I can clean the house. But I got to clean the house. And so now I'm currently working on my fourth step as laid out in the big book. And thank you, God, like, I see the sunlight of the Spirit. There was one day where I was doing my writing, and I just felt like my house was so cluttered. Like, I'm talking here, I guess, my spiritual house. And I haven't gotten rid of the records of the past yet, but I saw the sunlight of the Spirit, and I saw, as I wrote down the names, I could see where the clutter was. I could see the organization, and I could see what I've been carrying around in my head for so long. And it just gave me hope, because I heard somebody use this analogy the other day, that they went to visit Alcatraz, and that there's this beautiful view on the island of Alcatraz, but there's this wall that was blocking the prisoners, and the prisoners could never see the beautiful view because there was this wall there the whole time. And little did they know that they were in this beautiful place. And that's how I felt, like, God is out there. Not out there. God is inside me, deep down, fundamentally. The idea of God is inside me, but I just was so blocked off from it by every morning going over these resentments and stuff that I didn't even realize I was doing. So when I saw the sunlight of the Spirit, it's a little chink, in the wall of the prison, but I see it, and that gives me hope. People say that what keeps me going is the darkness behind me and the light in front of me, and that's true, because I know where I've been. I don't want to go back. I've seen my pictures. I've seen the red eyes, the bloated face, the acne, and just the greasy hair, and I'm not like that today, and that's by the grace of God. And also, I lost 45 pounds probably in program, and now I'm maintaining a goal weight. I'm about 5'6", and maintaining a goal weight of about 135, and just wanted to say that, but it's just to see the light in front of me and to experience that, I feel like I'm on the path, and it's a good path. And I understand now when they say trudge the road of happy destiny, sometimes it feels like trudging, because sometimes it's just monotonous and tedious, but it's so worth it. And I'm grateful to be able to share my story with you guys here, because these tapes have saved my life. I think I just, like, washed my brain with them when I was in college, because I got absent in college and worked at a program in a dorm room hall, and I was just grateful to have the willingness that God gave me to do that. And so thank you to everybody who's listening, and for those who have gone before me, thank you for the service. And I think that's it.